Welcome to Poems of Bewilderment and Loss. I'm Daniel Johnson, Executive Director of Mass Poetry. Thank you. We are proud to co-sponsor this event at the Boston Book Festival, featuring Nick Flynn, Martha Collins, and our host for the session is poet Fred Marchant. You're in great company. Mass Poetry is sponsoring five events today at the Boston Book Festival, so today chock full of poetry. If you want to learn more about Mass Poetry or what's on tap at the Boston Book Festival, see me in the back after. I'd love to tell you more. For the past 10 years, Mass Poetry, much like the Boston Book Festival, has helped fuel the literary renaissance taking place in Boston. We are headquartered in Fort Point. We support poets and poetry, all while aiming to transform lives through inspiring verse. From hosting the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, to placing poets for year-long residency in local schools, to exhibiting poems on the tee for millions of tee riders to enjoy, we aim to build community around poetry, and especially bring poetry to the places where it's needed most, like underserved schools, prisons, nursing homes, and perhaps when wandering through the streets of Boston or Massachusetts towns on a rainy day, you've come across one of our poems stenciled onto the sidewalk as part of our Raining Poetry project. I'll close by sharing a truly enticing update for writers and lovers of literature. In spring 2020, Grub Street, a partner of Mass Poetry's, will be opening the Center for Creative Writing at 50 Liberty in the Seaport. It's a 13,000 square foot space, including a branch of Porter Square Books, a podcast studio, literary stage, workshop space, and much more. It's right near the ICA. Mass Poetry will be an arts partner in residence there, offering expanded poetry programming, public art projects involving poetry. So please stand by for that. It'll be a hub for all things literary in Boston. And I'd like to invite you to become more involved with Mass Poetry. See me in the back after. You might sign our mailing list. Hope you'll plan to attend Evening of Inspired Leaders in March 2020 at the Huntington Theater with Lois Lowry, Rachel Rollins, and host of Luminaries. It is my great pleasure to welcome Fred Marchant.
My great pleasure to welcome all of you. Thank you for coming. I'm so glad that you're here to honor, recognize, and otherwise celebrate these two new books, Nick Flynn's I Will Destroy You and Martha Collins's Because What Else Could I Do? I'm going to give a brief introduction, then Martha will read for up to 20 minutes, then Nick will read for up to 20 minutes, and we'll build in 20 minutes for after talk. I have some basic questions and some topics, and we'll also open that up to conversation among you and among us. I want to begin by saying that I'm going to tell a story, basically. Many of you in the audience know that I taught for many, many years at Suffolk University. And in my second year of teaching there, I was teaching a freshman class. And I don't know what the poem was that I was teaching. It wasn't one of these, obviously. But it was something like, you know, one of John Berryman's dream songs. And I remember saying that this poem was courageous. And one of my best students ever in all of the years I taught was in the back of the room and challenged me about it. He raised his hand and said, how can poems be courageous? How can poets be courageous? How is courage a part of this? And so I don't know what I said, I have to tell you. I can't remember what I said. I remember so vividly. But I said something, I'm sure, that was reasonably okay. But it stayed with me forever. And I've been thinking about it ever since I was asked to introduce Martha and Nick. If I had had a time machine that day, if I have a time machine now, if I could fly back then, I'd bring these two books and say, my student's name was David. David, here is what I mean when I say poets can be courageous and poetry can be courageous. I know Martha and Nick well. I think both of them would probably challenge me about saying that about them right now. And so I'm going to say, I have to justify it a little bit. I don't mean to say they're heroic, or these poems are heroic. There are moments of heroism in them, I will say. But what I do want to say about their courage is that at the core, the etymological core of the word courage is are the roots for heart. And that's what these poems have. These poems are both heartbreaking and heart-affirming. You might be moved to tears and at the same time feel some strange sense of elation and affirmation. These are poems that both acknowledge how difficult life can be and how essential it is to continue in that project of trying to live as best you can. They remind me a little bit of Vaclav Havel's great description of what hope really consists of. Hope is not about the wishing for a good outcome. Hope is about the doing of something because it's essentially and fundamentally worthwhile. And when you hear these poems, I think you'll agree that there is something essentially and fundamentally invaluable in both the words you're hearing, the art with which they're expressed, and the two poets who have written them. First, Martha Collins.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you, Mass Poetry. Thank you, Nick Flynn, and thank you all for being here. I want to begin with a few words about the poems in this new book. Almost all of them were addressed to my husband, Ted, in the months following his death 3 years ago. At the time, I had no intention of publishing them or even of telling the story they recount, but here they are. Ted's death was in many respects a contradiction of his life. A man of great integrity, for whom truth was a way of being, he became, in his last days, a victim of lies. A man who believed deeply in reason, he lost, in those last days, his capacity to think rationally. A kind and gentle man, he came to a violent end. The story begins on August 25th when Ted sent me an email saying that the IRS was going to arrest him because, he said, of a legal mistake he'd made early in his law practice. It ends 9 days later on September 2nd. The poems are untitled. They're really, in some sense, just sections of one poem. I should also note that Ted and I had always commuted between his home in Hartford and my home in Cambridge. The first call, IRS said, arrest. You talked for 2 hours. Arrest, you told me. You called them back. I went to the IRS site. We never call, threaten arrest, it said. Scam. And you said, I thought, okay. Three days after I thought you'd agreed, scammers, you said, it's the IRS pretending they're scammers. You said, or it's scammers who know I'm being arrested. You said, I have to stay home to be arrested. Speechless, stunned, I finally said, I'm coming down there, not because I believe they're coming, but love. Because, but you'd already gone their way, your good mind arrested, already gone. That September morning, you drove into your driveway at 7:30, just as I was fetching the papers, drove from the wrong direction, I thought. And later that day would think you might have been seeking a place. But you really went to the gym that morning at 6:19, the woman said. Such a gentleman, everyone said. You went to the gym each day, taking care of yourself, 1,243 times, the woman told me. You read the papers or turned the pages so quickly. I was still on the front page. You tore out the weather as always and must have showered and changed while I went to the gym and must have written the tiny notes and signed the statement you wrote for your colleagues. And while I was in the shower, called the people who'd called the week before and called again that morning at 10:23, the machine said, final notice, IRS, and got in your car and drove. And why not the river, the beautiful, the only a mile away you could have, might have, didn't want? You and you and you and you and you still warm your face, your neck, your hands still warm your you, but not your you. You went. You left behind your you, not you, so cold. You, not you. Back I go back and do it over. It's 7:30. I drop the papers and put my arms around you and tell you. Back, I go back, it's the week before. I put my arms around you and say, I will never let you go. If those people come to take you away, I will not let you go, I say, I. Black car on the street could be your car. Could be you if they hadn't called that second time or the first. If you hadn't seen, did you see the police car parked in front of your house? The police I called because you hadn't come back for lunch. Or perhaps if I hadn't said 2 weeks before, but that was about how we could have lived in your house if you or I. How we could have driven to mine, oh love, if only, only you could be. I alone in a restaurant, and what is left of you at home, in a plastic box on your dresser where you kept your socks and put your change. And what will I do at home in my own house? What will I do with my one spoon and my wide bed? What will I do without, without? In the dream, we are standing together in your kitchen. We have just finished the dishes. You are wearing your blue shirt with the white stripes. I have my arm across your shoulders, and I am saying, I am so glad, and then my hand, so glad we could save you. November 8, 2016, Election Day. The what you will never, the what you missed, the reddening map, the can't be true, the what, the climate, the send them back, the end, the public, the health, the rights, the black, the planet, the white, the how did we fail, the what can we do, the how did I fail, the nothing to do. Drove your car home from your car you drove, first time I, since you drove, last time you, freezing rain. Grief's a lot like fear, someone wrote, I did not feel safe, and now none of us feels safe. Is this the end of every hour, end of our sun that day. Fear was your come to take you, put you away. Fear's a lot like grief. If we could stop beside the road and hold your fear, my. Overpass, over the no, don't go, past the please don't go, over the over and over again, the overpass, please no. Oh, I just saw you over the edge, and but no, I'm bringing you up in your blue-striped shirt, your black jacket in which you carried your wallet, some loose change, the tiny notes you'd written in that less than an hour after the call, one for whoever found you and one for me. Paper bag with empty box with almost empty plastic bag, and on my hands and on my jeans, you, some part or parts of you from when we sent you into the sea, low tide, so you easily rode the lightest currents in tiny explosions of white. And when we finished a sudden late sun on the water, of which you were becoming a part on runnels between patches of sand, as if you were signing yourself in silver. In the dream, we've disagreed. You've ordered twice as much fish as we need, and when I've complained, you've walked out of the store and left the fish, and I've walked out behind you and into the night, and the little beige heels I wore in the picture I sent before we met. And you've gone to the car, but I haven't followed. I'm walking home, and home is miles away in this town, which isn't your town or mine. And now it is dark, and there are no cars, no lights, and I am very afraid. I think I should not be walking alone and not in these shoes, but I am alone, and home is twice as far from here as I ever thought it would be. Another beach. The last one we walked together, hand in hand in the August sun. And I walked on while you rested there. And now it is winter, and I am here with almost the last of you in my hand, a tiny part of some parts of you, your hand, your blue eye, shoulder, mouth. And I try to gentle you in to the sea, but a sudden wave rushes over my feet, and the wind catches this part of some parts of you. And instead, you are in the air, and more than before, you are on me. You have met me again. You will not let me let you go. You are in the sea where you wanted to be, but you are also in air and sand and earth, where your grandson will bury another small part. And now I lick my finger, and you are in me. And with you went my summer sun, a friend or two, and who was there. And with you went the weeks to come, the months so far. So far, my one, my body too, the one I knew as one of two. Though you forgot to take desire, which now is wrapped in grief's long arms. And with you went the one I was, that was within, without, with you, mostly brave and largely true. The one I find some moments in some darkened place of joy, then lose. It's gone, your black car, whose trunk would open itself for my suitcase, whose seats would warm us, who came, you came, to me on weekends for 13 years and went to the Cape each summer, went for 163,000 miles, went to the store, the office, the gym. To the gym that morning before the second call, and home to the call, and an hour later went out and went through half a tank of gas. How many miles is that? And then, and maybe this is why I left the tank half full, you parked and turned the key for the last time. Report today, official, it said, 4 months later. 4 months after I'd called and written and called, it finally came and it said, not only your poor head trauma, chest trauma, lungs, broken bones, but your heart was already severe, already diseased. Your poor heart that weighed 380 grams, your severe heart, heavy with fear, panic, shame, was blocked. Oh, love, my sweet heart, your dear heart was already hurt, and no one knew. I had waited for the report, and when at last the report came, I asked, and she said, since your heart, your brain could also, but also said I should ask another. And so I asked, and he said, organic. And I said, are you sure? And he said, such sudden change is always. Oh, love, he was sure, so suddenly muddled your brain, your wounded brain. So, love, it was not the calls, the police car parked in front of your house, not the legal mistake you imagined you might have made. It was not the book you hid, the house where you thought they would be coming, that made you drive all afternoon and then park. It was none of this, I'm told. It was your brain, hurt like your heart, a thing that changed you so you no longer were yourself, your self. In your rust-colored jacket, your blue-striped shirt, on your skis in the woods, on the beach in the surf, your house in winter and spring, in your office chair in the yard with your kids, in California, in Florence, in Rome, your lilacs before they broke in the storm, your face, all over now. One month lived that morning over and over that awful afternoon, and 2 months wept and wailed, I'm sorry, sorry, why, screamed why in my car. And 3 months, then that news, that face in our faces, how, but always you. And 4 months, what could I, wrote my heart out, wrote your ashes into the sea. And 5 months, finally swallowed the fact, and then the new fact, organic, your brain. And 6 months wrapped myself in knowing, and now it has been 6 months to the day since you drove into your driveway. Good morning, my love. What a morning. The stars. And this is the last poem in the book. The lines I quote are from a very tiny poem I wrote some months before my husband died. This really happened. On the evening of the 6th month day, I drove into the hills, a rivered town, a little cafe to read my poems to strangers and friends. And at the end, I read, "Go with me into that night where one will go before." Read moon by night, read night, night, my love, by and by. And there was silence because, they told me after, when I read go, the door opened, but no one was there. And when I read by, the door closed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Really beautiful. This, I believe it's only the second time you've read from that book. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here at the Boston Book Festival and to be with Fred and Martha on this stage. I'm going to read from I Will Destroy You, and then we'll have a little conversation. Hi, everybody. I need glasses. This is called On the Anniversary of My Mother's Suicide. My daughter and I take the C train to the Museum of Natural History. Ladies and gentlemen, I am 17 years old, his T-shirt torn almost completely off his body. A woman in jeans, fashionably torn, looks up, but only once he has passed. I give my daughter a dollar, tell her she can either give it to him or keep it. At 81st, the doors open right into the museum. We don't have to step out into the cold at all. Her first stop is always the Hall of Asian Mammals to check in on the muntjac, on the spotted chevrotain, those Alice in Wonderland versions of deer. In the Hall of Reptiles, we play the blind game. She has me close my eyes, then leads me by the hand to a display case. Crocodile or python, whatever might make me scream. Now open your eyes, she says. This time, no shit, a giant frog with babies, lots of them, emerging weirdly from holes in her back. We spend our last hour watching lava set an island on fire, turning the ocean to steam. On the way home, she plays a game on my phone, the one where she's a chicken hopping across an endless highway, trying to avoid the traffic. Chicken dies, chicken comes back, chicken dies. It always ends with a truck. I'm writing this poem on the floor plan of the museum. Earlier, on the way to the train, it was snowing, and everyone was just walking through it. Daddy, my daughter says, you should put some dialogue in it. These days are so short. I'm 17 years old, someone says. She hands him the dollar. There's a few poems in this book that, while writing this book, it seemed like a lot of rock stars died. And so there's a few poems in here about that. I'm going to read a couple Prince poems. It's called Prince Performing Motherless Child Live. Somewhere, as I watch Prince sing Motherless Child on my phone, it's my mother's birthday. Both exist completely inside the song. I wouldn't change a thing. Flowers run through their veins now, so many it seems that inside each is a garden no one will ever wander. Each body can hold so much. Simply to stand requires a million constant and nearly imperceptible adjustments between falling and catching yourself as you fall. Look at how his body moves, both inside each note and as he creates each note. Can I play my guitar, he asks. We know, we know, we know. The song won't last forever. I'd like to read a poem I wrote as a collaboration with my dear friend Mark Adams. It's called Shipwreck, based on one of his paintings. I spent a lot of time in Provincetown. This is a Provincetown poem. A shipwreck. If one day you wake up on a beach and the nothing is recognizable, try looking into the sky. That sometimes helps, I hear. Though, aren't you tired of begging for a glimpse? Tired of asking what it is exactly we're waiting for? I know. Let's play the dying game again. First, make a list of the 10 things you cannot live without. A folding knife, a matchbook, a bottle of ink. Now wake up. One of your precious things has been washed away, carried out to sea by the tide. Cross that one off your list. Now wake up again. One more precious thing gone. You've woken up on this beach every morning of your life. All that you love has been leaving hour by hour. Not many left now. Now all you can do is name them. Apple, Buddha head. It would help if you could identify the birds for when you get hungry or sick. Not what we call them, but what they can do, what we can do with them. They too float in the sky above us, each feather as hollow as a poem. If only you could glimpse what's behind them, maybe then you could let them go. This is, I want to read this after reading Martha's book. This seemed to be an echo in these poems. This is called Tattoo. You do know, right, that between the no longer and the still to come, we are being continually tattooed, inked with the skulls of everyone we've ever loved, the you and the you and the you and the you. You don't sit in a chair, thumb through a binder, pick a design. It simply happens each time you bring your fingers to your face to inhale her back inside. Tiny skulls, some of us are covered. You, love, could simply tattoo an open door, light pouring in from somewhere outside. You could make your body a door, so it appears you, let me fill you, are made of light. This is another Prince poem. It's called Alphabet Street. You all know that song. Alphabet Street. Now, after when she, he dies, after a few hours of hearing her, his name on the radio, my daughter will ask, why was she, he so important? Why is anyone so important? I play her a song. We're going down, down, down. She listens, nods, begins to sway. He made us happy, I say. People are not replaceable, I say. No one, nothing, if that's the only way, is replaceable. It's always nice to read in a church. There's that triptych up there of a priest with his arms open. That could be you. This is a triptych, actually. This is three poems that sort of go together. I have a band that I play with, and these somehow have gone together into one piece, so I'm going to read them together. I'll read the titles first. Parrot. Stranger, uninvited, you come up to us on the sidewalk, my daughter's hand in mine. You look at her and coo. It goes so fast. What, stranger, is this unnamed it? This day? Her life? Our happiness? Stranger, maybe you missed it, but just now my daughter and I hurled rocks into the emptiness, and we created more emptiness. Killdeer. You know how it pretends to have a broken wing to lure predators away from its nest? How it staggers just out of reach? If at this moment you're feeling metaphorical, nest can be the whatever inside us that we think needs protection, though whatever that is small and hasn't yet found its way. Like us, it has lived so long on scraps, on what others have left behind. It thinks it could live on air, on words, forever almost. It thinks it would be better to let the predator kill it than to turn its back on that child again, forgetting that one lives inside the other. And here's the last one of that trilogy. Poem to be whispered by the bedside of a sleeping child. Here's the deal. If you die, then I will be able to drink again, and no one alive will even blame me. This child is the dark wind inside, but not the darkest. Then I think I'll have another child, a backup, in another city, with another woman, just in case. Then I think I'll call this poem to be whispered by the bedside of a sleeping child. So when you're older, you'll understand. Then I think, this isn't even a poem. I always worry about those that laugh at that. But in a compassionate way, I worry. Unghosted. I've tried to dream this lake into existence for years, and here it is, ta-da, illuminated briefly beneath our flare. You show me the birds that live underground, oil birds you call them. If you don't know how to walk, you'll break them. Your palm finds my scar. I hear the lake. Press harder, I say, until I don't know if my shoulders are the birds, or if my chest is their burrow, or if your hands put them there. But at some point, my body is not empty and wants things poured over and down its throat. What if it never was about finding our way back, but simply about our eyes becoming accustomed to this black water? Here's the thing. When I woke up, you were gone. It's okay. Everyone's gone eventually. But after, when I tried to put my own hand on my chest, when I tried not to break anything, I was a ghost touching a ghost. And the thing is, I didn't know I was a ghost until your hand found me. And now it has nowhere to go. Now, whatever those birds are will simply, what? Return to where they've been hiding? I have two more poems, and you can hold me to that. One of the worst things that a poet can do is say they have two more poems and then read three. At least for me, I find that unbearable. Amanuensis. I don't need to say what that is. You're at a poetry reading. It's a scribe. Amanuensis. This is a collaboration also with the artist and poet Rachel Eliza Griffiths. She's a photographer, and she asked me to write about a collection of photographs she had taken. If you write about painting yourself into a corner, I have lived so much with you not being here, then one day you might find yourself, in fact, painted into a corner. Or you might find yourself on the edge of a cliff, or maybe face down on the carpet in a white, white room. Why not then try to write yourself out into a field, say, or onto a country road, or knee deep in a river that might or must open into the sea? If you write it out, the words could become clear, not blurry, no, like that photograph of your mother, calm, looking straight into the you you are now, as she holds onto the you you were then, as you both play struggle against her. And I'll finish with this poem. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And then we'll have a little talk, and then we'll be done. This poem takes its title from a line from Ilya Kaminsky, his book, Deaf Republic. The title is, "If I Speak for the Dead, I Must Leave." You opened my mouth and filled it with stones. For days, then weeks, then years, we swam until we couldn't. Like horses, our bodies, little noises, now this, now this, until it didn't make any sense. Did we really believe that if we could just return to the source and fully, we might then be able to sink back into it? I woke up in a boat once. I couldn't remember. I opened my mouth and then, little snake, you were gone. I didn't know you might not come back. Once I could say I'd never kissed anyone who is now dead. Once that was true. As if my lips were a cure, as if death wasn't the only reason we got into that boat. It held us for as long as it did. That's all we can say, until it didn't. Thank you. I don't know why I'm moving. Seems like that should be your chair. Should this one in the middle? We'll put Fred in the end. Okay.
You need those books.
You do need these books. You're in the middle. Yeah, yeah.
You have to moderate.
Yeah. And then you keep us apart from fighting.
I'm not a moderate. No, I'm not a moderate person. But I will moderate. Well, you know how to. So, you know, you come up here and start cracking jokes, right?
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Well done.
Yeah. I want to say that it's such a privilege to be between and among these two poets. And I am going to try to be, you know, with you folks. I'm going to be one of you. And the first thing I know that every one of you will do is that when you buy these books, and you may indeed buy them, you'll study these covers. I know I did. I could not take my eyes off of them. And so I have as my first sort of region of conversation is that I'd like both of you to tell us more about your covers and how you arrived at the, you know, because I know you both also had a say in these covers, and how, if you'd say a word about them and how they relate to what's inside. So I don't know who would like to go first. Martha?
Okay. Some months after my husband died, I saw an exhibit of sculpture by Doris Salcedo at the Harvard Art Museums. She's a Chilean sculptor. It was called The Materiality of Mourning, with a U. And among the sculptures there were these shirts that were made of needles and silk thread. And I didn't even know I was going to have a book at that point, but I kept a copy of one of those, a photograph of one of those paintings on my wall. And when the book came to be, I knew that was what I wanted. There is a poem in the book that I did not read that actually refers to and quotes from Doris Salcedo and this particular work.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing image. It's such a perfect, it's so ghostly, the cover is so, like, it's really, really striking. My picture is a child, a little sort of wood fairy dancing with a giant sort of bear bat person by a waterfall. And this is the wood sprite is my daughter. And the book sort of began almost from this, in some ways, from this photograph being taken. There's a friend of mine, this collaborative artist. I do a lot of collaboration with different artists. And when you meet up with these two friends, Richard and Nicholas, you just have to sort of unload their van and you carry like duffel bags into the woods, and then you get in costumes and they take photographs of you. And so my daughter had just reached, she'd turned 7, and she suddenly became like, they thought that she'd be very good as a wood sprite, and she was. But the poems, I really wanted it for the cover of the book because it really felt like that a lot of the poems sort of burst forth from this moment. So it seemed really right for the book, so, yeah.
You know, I'll ask a couple of more questions about this. For instance, Martha, the poem you didn't read does talk about how this shirt, it is ghostly, and it's really fragile, and yet it's painful to, it feels like a hair shirt. I never wore one, but I understand they were painful to wear. And then there's something about it that, and in the poem too, that as one wears these shirts, this mourning shirt, it does seem to me at least that it draws you closer to the person who has left and has passed away. And so there's something about this image that seems to be both, you know, it brings the person closer. Would you say that's too much reading into the cover?
Well, let me just read the end of
Good
that
idea.
Poem. With traces of lost threads and thread and needles it's made from. Thread by thread, not to manage grief, but needle by needle inserted raw in the center of our lives to appear and disappear, the absent almost within, but not to touch.
Thank you, Martha. And Nick, I have seen the film.
Yes,
that this
yes.
is part of, and it is. It's a dance, and when I look at this photograph, the first thing I see beyond the general thing is that foot that's raised up, mm-hmm. and I thought it was a bear at first, but it is a bat.
They call it a bat. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is a dance. It's a dance on a lake, and I started thinking about all the different kinds of dances, strange dances that one might think of in relation to this book. I made some notes now, Dance of Death, but also, you know, a dance of innocence too, for that matter, at the same time. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe this is an image of the psyche itself. This is inside of one person. Even Nick Flynn's mind could be, you know, this figure dressed up as a beast and this beautiful child dancing with the beast.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot that it goes with the title. Yeah, it also is creepy to have this sort of little child in this, I will destroy you, underneath it. So I thought that was because I think the image is very sort of beautiful, but also sort of odd. What's a child doing dancing with a giant bear? And then to put, I will destroy you, we're not sure who's speaking there, mm-hmm. or if it's the child will destroy the bear, or if the bear will destroy the child. So I thought that there was something about that weirdness of juxtaposing those together was very important. And there is a film that goes with this, although the film was made sort of surreptitiously, like not by the artist, but by someone who was just there.
Ah.
Made a film, and then I didn't see it until the book came out, and then someone said, oh, have you seen
is
this
that
film?
Right?
Yeah,
oh.
yeah. So it's a really cool little film about that day, about sort of putting this stuff together that day.
When I was talking to Martha a couple of weeks ago when this first started to come together, I had the two books sort of sitting on my desk like this, and then like this, and I started thinking, God, these titles somehow complement each other, or at least give you chills when you do it, you know? I will destroy you, because what else could I do?
Oh, yeah, that's nice, yeah.
Because
yeah,
what else could nice. I do? I will destroy you.
You can put them like this, like
this
on
right.
your shelf, yeah, that's nice.
So I started thinking, you know, that there's something in this that has a lot to do, both, and I'm stepping back now to put my arms out in that sense, both poets are, you know, writing out of love and, you know, a sense of threat, both simultaneously present, you know. And I started to think about how dangerous it is to love anyone, you know, and the images actually suggest that to me. And so I wonder if you could say how these titles came to you.
Why did you have to step back just now?
I don't know why. I wanted to, as Martha's line about grief and embracing, you know.
It got me so nervous. I was like, what's Fred doing?
Actually, I can't get up in these high chairs. That's right.
So what was the question? I'm sorry, what was the question?
I sort of gave you my sense of these titles being so beautiful and so strange, and, you know, both complimentary. And also I said, well, wait, how did these titles come to you for these books? Yeah, why don't we start with
you?
Well,
I was telling Martha before we came out that I had the title before I had the poem. I have a title poem here called I Will Destroy You. And I had the title, you know, often my last book was called My Feelings, and there's a whole story behind that. And I also called that book My Feelings before I had any poem called My Feelings. And my editor at Grey Wolf at that time, when I gave him the manuscript, and it was called My Feelings, he was like, no, seriously, what are you going to call a book? And he really hated that title. So I had to write these poems that would actually convince him that it was the right title for the book. And then I actually dedicated the book to him. So just to Just to horrify him.
Make sure.
Yeah. My feelings dedicated to Jeff Schatz. I was very sincere about it. Like, I really was dedicating it to him because he did push me. He pushes me to do things. It just sort of like the book deals with like various types of reckless behavior and, trying to sort of like push against that reckless behavior and trying to sort of, there's sort of a sense of, impending or the possible threat of annihilation. And yet how do we, what happens on the other side of that? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that is in there. And the I Will Destroy You could be, to push against that or it could be to embrace it. So it just felt like the right title.
I remember when, before the book had come into being, maybe a couple of years ago, I bumped into Nick at AWP and he had the title. And he said it to me just to gauge my shock, right? He said, it's I Will Destroy You. And I went, but it is so wonderful a title.
It also felt wrong. It also felt wrong too, like my feelings. So that's usually my gauge for naming something if it feels really wrong.
It's right.
As I said at the beginning, I really didn't intend to publish these poems. I write in a notebook with a pen, the old way. And I do a lot of writing and rewriting in there. And when I got to the second notebook, I kind of put a title. I just wrote, because what else could I do? Because what else can I do? And there's actually a poem in the book that alludes to the title. It's an angry poem. It starts out, thought of writing for all the world, those bastards, they, how could, but how could I? And then it ends, but now, what else can I do? And so it was there with me as a way of talking to him and saying, I really didn't mean to write all this down, but what else can I do?
Mm, thank you, Martha. I did notice that there were the pieces of the title were in several poems. Yeah. My third general topic, and then what time?
7 minutes.
Got 3 minutes?
Total?
Total?
And then we go to questions.
Yeah.
Oh, and then we go to questions. Okay, good. Okay. This is a question about the style of both of...
Yeah.
Right. We end at 3:30. Yep. This is a question about the style. And we heard, your ears are all registering the subtle variations of style in both Martha's fragmentary, the broken syntax, or the elliptical syntax is what I would call it, sentences with missing elements in them. And there's a great sort of interiority that comes with that, that you sense you're with the poet in her thought and feeling. And so, Martha, and I know this has been a part of your style from the beginning, but can you say how it works in this book? And I guess that's not a great question, but the way in which it does work.
Does it? It is true. I've been writing this way for a while, and I've been writing about difficult subjects for a while, and the first real book where I did that was a book about a lynching that my father witnessed, and I found myself literally breaking off. I couldn't complete thoughts. And it sort of became a way of allowing myself to write down things I didn't yet know the answers to or the end to or anything else. And in a way, I think it's the way many of us think, isn't it? That we don't finish our thoughts. And so I've sort of allowed myself to not finish my thoughts.
Thank you, Martha. You really intuited the premise behind that remark of mine, that these are difficult subjects, and this is a style which acknowledges the profound difficulty of saying anything. And I also want to turn to Nick. We all know Nick's associative style, how it moves this way and that so quickly. However, there is one poem in this book that has a kind of broken, deliberately broken up. And I was wondering, when you get to it, you'll see what it looks like. It's Salt Marsh, and it's page 56. And I'll show you what I had to do to read it. I had to figure out. And so this is what happened as I started to read it. I had to go like this to read read a poem in which things were flying apart. And I like Martha's poem about the ocean, the springing into the air. So Rick. Rick, let's get Rick in here. Okay.
Rick, yeah.
But Nick, could you read one line of these, even just to sort of make sure that I wasn't standing on my head?
A line of the broken part,
yeah.
The dissolved part. It's a poem called Salt Marsh, and it says that it's about dissolving, and then the poem dissolves itself. Dissolves. Oh, I don't know if I can read it.
You have to stand on your head like this.
The ocean is always here inside us. Close your eyes and walk, then walk faster. I want you, your body, to know when it will fall. I want you to get used to it.
Yeah.
But I just made that up. I can't read that.
That's part of it. You can't read it.
I think that's it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't read it, but it is interesting. And in a sense, the both poets really do ask us to read. You know, read silently, read.
Yeah. There's something really about Martha's poems, those lines that just end and stop, that really keep me really awake, like reading the poems. Like I'm really like in it, like I'm like, oh, wait a minute, the thought just ended, it stopped. And I really admire that greatly. And then there's another poem that when you read it out loud, I really heard it too, the Can You Drive poem. There's a poem about Can You Drive? And it feels like an erasure. It's like, it feels like you actually erased the poem. Like it feels very different even than just not finishing a thought, but actually going through that idea of someone and as a mirror of death or something too.
We're going to stop now. We've got 5 minutes left. Or no?
We don't.
We don't have anything.
You can ask us questions at the table.
At the table, all right. There'll be books for sale, and the authors will be here. Thank you all.
Thank you.